Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, it wasn't just Arizona. The Supreme Court yesterday made at least three other interesting and important rulings about a cross on public land, minors sentenced to life without parole, and whether states can get around Citizens United. We will break them down now with Supreme Court watcher Dahlia Lithwick from Slate and preview the health reform decision, which we can now say with confidence will come on Thursday, despite the court's best efforts to always obscure when they're going to announce anything. Hi, Dahlia. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Now, perhaps the decision of most interest to our listeners, other than the Arizona law yesterday, was about the court's own much maligned Citizens United ruling from 2010, allowing unlimited and anonymous money into election campaigns. How did they come to address Citizens United again?
Well, because the Montana Supreme Court tried to overrule them. Last winter, the Montana Supreme Court took a look at its own 1912 campaign finance law and said, you know what? Citizens United doesn't apply to this law. And the Supreme Court of that state, by a 5-2 vote, said, it's really different in Montana. We have an actual factual history of real corruption. The government at the time was really just a shell, and the big so-called copper kings ruled the land. And so the argument really was, this doesn't have anything to do with Justice Kennedy's finding that there was no corruption or appearance of corruption. We'll show you corruption. Therefore, Citizens United doesn't apply to us. And needless to say, nobody smacks down the U.S. Supreme Court and gets away with it.
I guess. Here is Montana's Attorney General, Steve Bullock, speaking yesterday after the order.
From my perspective, it's a sad day for democracy, not only in Montana, but also across the entire nation.
So, you know what I'm curious about, Dahlia? Why did this come from Montana? I know you just explained some of the history, but any state could make that argument that unlimited anonymous campaign donations have resulted in corruption. I certainly could make that argument about Albany, even donations with names attached to them. You wouldn't think of it as a progressive bastion of hatred for Citizens United, Montana, that a New York or a California or Massachusetts might be and find a way to do this.
Well, first of all, there were 22 other states that joined with Montana.
Oh, they did. I didn't know that.
Yeah, there were other states, including New York, saying, hey, we want to hold on to our own campaign finance regulations for our own reasons. So the court didn't just say no to Montana. They said no to all the other states who also wanted to preserve their state campaign finance reform laws. But like I said, Montana has this really, really interesting history at the turn of the century where these kind of so-called copper barons really were from out of state running the state government. And there was such a, in their view, and these are opinions that are worth reading, the Montana Supreme Court opinions, there was a really deep sense that Montana was special in that the corruption was ran so deep and was so prevalent that these campaign finance laws were really necessary. And so even though you may not think of Montana as a bastion of, you know, open government, I think in this particular case, there was a sense that Montana really, really, really wanted these laws in 1912 and really wants them now. One other thing that's interesting in the case is that one of the groups that had planned this big media blitz that was suing to get the campaign finance laws set aside quite literally promised in its promotional materials, Brian, that, quote, no politician, no bureaucrat, no radical environmentalist will ever know that you helped make this program possible. So there was promises of secret donations and anonymity that I think really made it look as though this was going one step further than Citizens United.
Let's take a call on this. Nick in Cliffside Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Brian. My question to your legal expert is how will this affect the anti-pay-to-play laws that exist. In New Jersey, we've had the roughest time getting minimal laws passed, and now it looks like the Supreme Court is bound and determined to legalize bribery in every way it can and to make it anonymous. It's so discouraging. It's as if our country is being taken over by corruption. How can this be legal?
Nick, thank you. So how does it affect pay-to-play or anti-pay-to-play laws in New Jersey? How does it affect New York City's very progressive campaign finance law, which if you only accept small donations, you get like six times as much from federal public funding and matching funds. Does any of this get affected by this ruling?
Well, I mean, I think the really important issue here is that, you know, as it stands now, all the campaign finance laws that, you know, are implicated in Citizens United are still implicated, and that no state can go further than Congress did with McCain-Feingold. The important thing I guess I want to say to the caller is that there are all sorts of fixes that are in play right now that are not happening in the courts, that if people care deeply, and I know people care deeply about Citizens United, things to think about are, you know, there's certainly a move to amend the Constitution. I don't know how far that's going to go, but legislative fixes that would force disclosure in ways that we don't currently have. There's a real move, I think, to get the regulatory agencies to do their jobs such that the SEC is really regulating and that the IRS is really regulating. So I guess I think that folks who feel that post-Citizens United, there's nothing to be done, there's a lot to be done.
Listeners, your calls on any of the decisions the Supreme Court came down with yesterday, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to our page at WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. One more thing on this, and then we'll move on to some of these other decisions. You know, liberals had hoped for the court to signal it might have some regrets about its Citizens United decision, seeing the pernicious effects that many believe it has already had on our democracy. Is this, in effect, a very direct statement by the five-justice majority, including Kennedy, that, sorry, America, we have no regrets about Citizens United?
I think it's pretty clearly that. I think that folks who thought that maybe 2 years later, and specifically at the urging of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer, who had both written quite forcefully and said, let's take this Montana case and let's really apply the facts and not kind of airy-fairy First Amendment doctrine, I think there was a sense that maybe the court would look again, but it was a long shot at best, Brian, and I think asking the five conservatives in the majority on Citizens United to say, hey, actually, we were completely wrong 2 years ago was probably a stretch. And I layered over that just the indignity of having a state Supreme Court more or less nullify your decision is not the way you want to get that done.
Dahlia Lithwick, Supreme Court watcher from Slate. All right, another decision, much less publicized, involves a cross on a war memorial in San Diego. This is at the top of Mount Soledad in San Diego, for anybody who knows that area. The cross is 43 feet high, was erected in 1954, and according to what I've read, has hundreds of plaques memorializing individual veterans, regardless of their own religions, affixed to this Christian symbol. What's the constitutional question here, Dahlia?
It continues to be this ongoing question, and in 2010 we had a similar case involving a memorial cross that was congressionally endorsed, but it was nevertheless a religious symbol in the Mojave Desert. The court refused to order that removed in 2010. So this is this ongoing fight about crosses in public spaces and whether they violate the First Amendment, whether they violate the notion of church-state entanglement. And the court is really, really interesting on these cases because there are people like Samuel Alito, for instance, and Antonin Scalia who feel very, very strongly on these religious expression cases, and so they make their voices heard. So I think there's always a hope by some of the groups that bring these challenges that maybe this is the case where the court clarifies what exactly is the rule for something that is both a religious symbol, a cross, and also a memorial, a secular symbol. What is the rule going to be? And I think there was some hope that the court would clarify it this time, but they are not hearing it.
They're not hearing it. And it looks to me like the Supreme Court basically said it cannot rule on this case yet because the lower court hadn't decided on a remedy, which could be to remove the cross. So this case might bubble back up to the Supremes?
I think it might bubble back up. And as I said, I think there's a very strong minority of justices who very, very desperately want to get to this issue.
Yeah. Would this be different, the lower court's ruling that said the cross should be, is not okay there, if this site had multiple religion symbols, not just one religion? Is this about establishing one religion or over another?
And in one of the in the 2010 case, I think there was a suggestion that if other religious memorials could be erected, it wouldn't be a problem. As I said, this goes to this very fundamental question. And I remember in the 2010 case, Justice Scalia saying, who thinks that a cross is a religious symbol? It's a memorial. And the ACLU attorney, who was Jewish, said, you know what? Nobody in my family's ever been buried under a cross.
Yeah, I think a few Jews might agree with that. Interesting to note also that it's the U.S. Justice Department arguing that the cross can stay on federal land. That wouldn't seem like a Barack Obama, Eric Holder position.
Well, that was another oddity of the 2010 case, Brian, was that the actually Elena Kagan argued that case when she was Solicitor General, and they defended a Bush policy on that.
So she would have to recuse herself if it comes back as an actual Supreme Court case that they accept?
I don't know that she has to recuse herself. If she didn't work on that specific case, I'm not sure that she has to recuse herself.
Because that was a related but different case. And last thing on
this,
if this cross is ordered removed, would the decision have implications for creches at city halls in Christmas season and, get another round of war on Christmas shows going on conservative talk shows?
Well, rules, while inexplicable, are kind of unrelated. I've always called this the Teddy Ruxpin rule, and this goes back to Sandra Day O'Connor saying, as long as you throw in a teddy bear and a reindeer and a menorah, the creches are okay. And so they kind of throw in teddy bears and antlers. And so I think that there is some sense that the creches are immunized by putting in other religious symbols around them. The cross cases, in some senses, are harder because they're sort of claiming quite explicitly to be secular symbols.
Jarrell in Manhattan also wants to comment on the Citizens United decision. Jarrell, thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you, Brian. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Oh, great. I just want to say, Lakoff is always talking about, framing. And
George Lakoff, the politically liberal linguist. Go
exactly,
ahead.
Exactly. Precisely. And I find him compelling, and I don't even know that he's spoken about Citizens United, but to me it's such a horrible name because it sounds good. It's like the Republicans are so they're excellent at framing, and the death tax and all the other things that they've named, and
right.
We just take those names up, and I mean Democrats and liberals are bad at exploiting publicity, at PR. I mean, we know that.
I will say, though, that Citizens United is, and Dahlia, correct me if I'm wrong, it's the name of an interest group that wanted to spend a lot of money as a so-called independent group in a political campaign, and so they were the plaintiff in the case, and that's why it's Citizens United, and that groups on all sides of the political spectrum try to take these neutral mom and apple pie sounding names, Americans for Good Things, and then use that name as cover for whatever your special interest spending is. Yes?
That's exactly right. Citizens United was simply the name of the group that promoted Hillary, the movie, which was an attack movie on Hillary Clinton.
Right. Though still, Jarrell, I get your point when we say Citizens United. It does. It sounds like mom and apple pie. Citizens. Citizens United. It's a good thing. And that's the shorthand that everybody refers to this ruling by. We'll continue in a minute with Dahlia Lithwick from Slate. We'll get to another Supreme Court ruling from yesterday, which was about whether a 14-year-old can be sentenced to life in prison without parole. And very briefly, preview the healthcare ruling now expected Thursday. Stay tuned. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Slate Supreme Court watcher Dahlia Lithwick as we talk about mostly about yesterday's Supreme Court decisions other than the Arizona immigration one. We will touch on Arizona and how confusing that really was and the coming health reform ruling before we finish. But next case, the court decided that minors may not be sentenced to life in prison without parole. Who was the specific minor involved in this case, Dahlia?
There were two specific minors, and they both committed fairly unspeakable acts. Both were 14. One of them was, I'm trying to see his first name here.
Sorry, and I don't have it either.
Yeah, I'll have it in a second. One of them, they both committed horrible acts. One of them got drunk with a friend, in another friend's trailer, and then they burnt the trailer down and killed the inhabitant. The other one, Jackson, actually was just standing with a gun when someone else shot a convenience store clerk in the course of a robbery. So actually, there's quite a big difference between the two of them, which comes up in Justice Breyer's concurrence. But the point is, they both are involved in homicides. Felony murder rule says if you're in taking part in a burglary and somebody gets shot, you're tagged with the homicide too. Both are sentenced under mandatory life without parole statutes in their states. That means that the judge has no discretion that if they've committed these crimes, they go to jail for life without parole. And that's the challenge, is whether that violates the Eighth Amendment.
And so the court ruled unambiguously in both cases and applicable to all cases from any state that you may not sentence someone under 18 to life without parole. Was it that broad?
No. What they said is in the 29 states that currently have life without parole, the judge has to have the discretion to say, you know what, I'm going to deviate from that sentence because of this person's youth. So they don't do away with life without parole, and people will still get life without parole. But the idea that it's mandatory and judges and jury have no discretion within that, that's gone away. And that's unequivocally 5-4.
Yeah. Mandatory life without parole for minors.
That's right.
It was ruled cruel and unusual punishment under the Constitution. So we've discussed the Fed stopping states from incarcerating minors for life without parole, without judicial discretion. The federal Citizens United decision, meaning states may also not limit campaign-related spending. And in the Arizona ruling, the states may not have their own immigration policies. So it was a very good day for federal power and a bad day for the 10th Amendment.
And it's interesting because it reminded me yesterday that this is not the Rehnquist Court. You may recall when you and I first started talking back in the years of the Rehnquist Court, there was a so-called federalism states' rights revolution, and it was spearheaded by people like then Chief Justice William H. Rehnquist and Sandra Day O'Connor, who were very, very strong supporters of the notion of states' rights. And, you know, there's all sorts of chatter among court watchers about what happened to the federalism revolution. But I think one of the things we see today is that there just aren't the same five passionate voices that we had in the Rehnquist era to say states have rights, too.
All right. Arizona, briefly, this is such a mixed ruling. I think that's the most important thing for us to say about it after yesterday's show when we were covering it, coming out, and trying to make sense of it on the fly. I think both sides are pretty unhappy. Correct me if I'm wrong. But most of the law was thrown out. And yet the most offensive part to Latinos was allowed to stand, the so-called show us your papers provision. Here is Arizona Governor Jan Brewer after the ruling.
Arizona is prepared to move forward to enforce this law that we have fought so hard to defend.
So damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead on Show Me Your Papers. Remind us exactly what this allows or requires police officers to do.
Well, what this means is that if the police stop you in the course of believing that they have reasonable suspicion that you are committing some other illegal act, so they can't just stop you. You have to be jaywalking or driving with an expired license. If they stop you and have reason to believe that you are an undocumented alien, they then have to undertake what's called a status check. They have to check with the federal authorities and make sure you're here legally. So that is the part of the law. It's been called the Show Me Your Papers law, that the court says, not necessarily that they uphold, and I think there's some confusion about this. The court says this issue isn't yet ripe. We haven't seen this law go into effect. We haven't seen how it plays out. We need to see how this happens on the ground and what state courts think. If it turns out that this is where the racial profiling happens, and remember, racial profiling is not in the case yet, if this turns out to be administered in a racially discriminatory way, or if folks are held beyond what they would be held for the traffic stop, then Anthony Kennedy leaves open the possibility that they come back and challenge it again. Mm. So essentially, this is not ripe. The court can't hear it yet.
Could this ruling have implications for the constitutional challenge to New York City's stop and frisk program, which includes a racial profiling claim?
Will have implications to, well, I don't know if it will have implications outside of the immigration context. I haven't thought about that. It's a good question. I think it will certainly allow states to do all sorts of things that they might not have undertaken otherwise in the field of enforcing their own immigration law, because the court doesn't unequivocally say, hey, you know, nobody but the federal government has immigration power. So I think you may see states experimenting with immigration laws going forward. But I also think, without a question, that the court leaves aside the whole issue. Kennedy's quite clear that he's leaving aside the issue of racial profiling for another day. There's already suits filed in Arizona that raise the racial profiling issue. And so I think what Kennedy more or less is saying is, listen, our doors are open. If this is administered in a way that offends civil liberties, come back and we'll look at it again. So I don't think it's an unequivocal victory for Jan Brewer, although I think an awful lot of people are going to get pulled over in Arizona for discriminatory reasons until this law gets clarified.
And briefly on the Obama health reform law, that decision now expected Thursday. I've had trouble all along in this case finding the constitutional principle on which the individual mandate would be struck down. Healthcare is interstate commerce, so the Commerce Clause probably allows the government to regulate health insurance markets in some way. But it seems to me that the Constitution has nothing to say, and this is my opinion, so I'm labeling it as my opinion, and I'm not a constitutional lawyer. But it seems to me the Constitution has nothing to say one way or another whether they regulate it by forcing Americans to buy it or some other way. What's the constitutional claim of the Obama law opponents?
Well, the claim is that they are, for the first time in history, being forced to purchase a product, a good or service that they don't want from a private entity. And that's the claim, and you're quite right, and you're not alone. Most legal scholars and constitutional law scholars would say it's a completely novel claim, and B, a claim that's been settled since the 1930s, that all this is swept in under the Interstate Commerce Clause, and that there's no there. So I think one of the things that's really fascinating to track about this case, Brian, is that 2 years ago when the suits were filed, people were talking the way you are. They were saying, what does it mean to be, you're forced to purchase something? First of all, it's just a little tax, and second of all, you're forced to do things all the time, and second of all, if you decide not to buy health insurance, there's this little penalty, so what's the problem? 2 years later, there. Well, they won in a couple of lower courts. They won in a court of appeals. And now it really has legs. This is not
right.
so
but,
much.
But story. Because we're almost out of time, I mean, can you say in a succinct 15-second soundbite that this is a second, First Amendment challenge, a Fourth Amendment challenge? It's the X clause of the body of the Constitution. Where does it say something that's relevant?
They say that this violates the Commerce Clause because this is beyond the scope of interstate commerce.
I see, because it's regulating individuals, so it's not interstate commerce. Do you think there are any health reform tea leaves to read in the fact that Chief Justice Roberts voted with the liberals on the Arizona law yesterday and left Scalia and Alito and Clarence Thomas behind?
I think that could cut either way. I think it either means that he's leaving space to do something different on Thursday, or I think it could mean that he wants to distance himself a little bit from that wing of the court. But I think it's a wash, and I think most of these tea leaves are ultimately pretty futile in terms of predicting what's going to happen Thursday.
And just as a side note, Obama's Solicitor General Vermilier. His name is something like that. I'm forgetting his exact name. Verrilli. Who got so knocked for doing a terrible job in his presentation on health care, was also criticized for doing a terrible job in the oral arguments on Arizona. And still they mostly won. So that's just folks to say, don't let the performance at the oral arguments let you think this is going to go one way or the other necessarily on Thursday. Dahlia Lithwick, Legal from Slate, watching the Supreme Court. Very informative. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Brian.